Jay Matthews, a longtime education reporter at the Washington Post and author of its Class Struggle column, is the rare journalist who seems to like telling hopeful stories. Decades ago, he wrote Escalante, The Best Teacher in America, about the teacher who was later featured in the movies Stand and Deliver. And now he's written another cheerful profile, this time of Mike Feinberg and Dave Levin, the founders of the uber-successful KIPP schools. We'll talk with Jay about his book, Work Hard, Be Nice, about what KIPP means for the larger education reform debate, and whether Hollywood has bought the rights to his story. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So has Hollywood bought the rights to this story yet?
Not yet. Hollywood, you know, is in a crisis. They don't have as much space for, you know, telling great stories about teachers as they once did. But I have hope. There's the elements of this tale, two really wonderfully entertaining and goofy 20-somethings and a two veteran teachers who are completely over the top in terms of humor and personality, I think works.
All right. Well, good. All right. Well, we'll let you make the pitch later on as well. Mm-hmm. So let's start by talking about the book again, Work Hard, Be Nice, and why you decided to write it. So why did you think it was important to tell the KIPP story?
Well, you know, it's a direct line of discovery from the book about Jaime Escalante that I wrote, came out in 1988. That was my first, that was the book that made me an education writer, discovering that in this high school, which everyone thought was one of the worst high schools in the country, I was finding low-income kids whose parents had never got back the sixth grade were taking and passing the most difficult academic challenge we had in high school, the AP calculus exam. That didn't make any sense. And once I spent, you know, 5 years there, I realized that these teachers, it wasn't just Jaime Escalante, but a lot of other teachers, realized that if you took low-income kids and gave them enough extra time and encouragement, they could do anything. It was just a matter of believing in them and giving them the extra time and encouragement they needed. And there was a word that Jaime used called ganas, you know, that was the extra effort a kid would give to help make sure that he learned the lesson or did something good. And that was a watchword, and you know, that word was stuck in my head when I heard in 2001, just as charter schools were blossoming in D.C., that there was a charter school starting in a basement of a church in Anacostia, you know, the poorest part of D.C., something called KIPP, short for Knowledge is Power Program, and that it was interesting. So I went to interview the principal, and there was this woman named Susan Scheffler. She was not quite 30 years old. She had no experience running a school. She had been a teacher in D.C. for 6 years. She'd been on Teach for America, but, you know, no administrative experience. And she was going to start, she'd gotten a charter to start this rather unusual middle school. And she was explaining to me, this was in 2001, that we're going to start with the fifth grade, and we're not going to call them fifth graders. We're going to call them the class of 2009. And I said, well, gee, I get it. So that's the year. No, it was her dad actually was there and said, oh, I get it. That's the year they're all going to graduate from high school, right? And she said to her father, no, Dad, that is the year they are all going to college. And it struck me that if I had this 30-year-old with 80 fifth graders from Anacostia, all very poor black kids, and was saying that all of them are going to college in 8 years, that was something worth covering. So I, you know, I latched on to her efforts, and her school grew. She started some new schools, and I met the founders of KIPP, Mike Feinberg and Dave Levin, who had all the traits of Jaime Escalante. You know, they were wild, they were funny, they were outrageous. They drove administrators and superintendents nuts. But they really understood that if you gave low-income kids extra time and encouragement, you could do wonderful things. And the KIPP was based on the same principles as Jaime Escalante had to, you know, trick kids into staying after school for extra 3 hours to do their homework and to get into the subject. Mike and Dave just started schools that had those extra 3 hours built into the program. You know, you came to school at 7:30, you didn't leave until 5. And what they did with that, you know, inspiration was far more than Jaime did, because they were, you know, they'd born in this country, they were young, they had a long career ahead of them. They could really expand their insight, whereas Jaime came to teaching late in his life in the United States and didn't have much time to really expand what he had done.
So you decided clearly to make this book about Mike and Dave, Mike Feinberg and Dave Levin, the founders of KIPP. Why did you make that decision? Why focus on them instead of KIPP more broadly?
Well, I mean, you mentioned the movie, and they did make a movie about Jaime Escalante. It was clear when I started interviewing Jaime Escalante that he was a movie figure. I mean, well, larger than life, full of great jokes. He did outrageous things. You know, his life is full of great crises, fights. The most interesting being, you know, the accusation of kids cheating. Mike and Dave were in the same boat. You know, I started talking to them about how they got into teaching, and they had the wonderful story of being, thinking themselves God's gift to, you know, American education and women and basketball. They were two very headstrong, self-important Ivy League graduates who went off to teach for America and got teaching assignments in Houston, thought they would be terrific. And the minute they started in the classroom, they realized they were awful, just terrible. Now, their classes were in chaos, and they had no idea what to do. And they tried to work very hard to find some secret to get through at least that first year so they wouldn't be completely ashamed of themselves. And they ran into the person who would be the key, you know, figure in any movie about Kip, you know, played by Whoopi Goldberg in my imagination, Harriet Ball, who was this veteran teacher who was teaching a class across the hall from Dave's class. His class was in chaos. Her class worked like clockwork. And she had, Dave perceived as he was listening to what was happening as he passed her classroom, invented all these chants and songs and games which kept kids absolutely engaged in what they were learning. Her test scores were way up here. His were way down here. Discipline was not a problem. Kids were doing exactly what they were told in her class and having fun. He could hear them singing some of her songs on the playground. And so Mike and Dave essentially adopted Harriet. You know, they'd go off, they'd try to invite her to a bar or something afterwards so they could, you know, suck more information out of her, invite her, you know, invited themselves to her house on weekends. And she essentially, you know, a woman who grew up in the ghetto of Houston, taught these two guys how to teach. And they used, she gave them the permission to use all her tactics to start this system. She wouldn't go there herself because she said it was too big a risk. She had four kids and she needed to divest her pension. You know, they could take the chance. She would just give them the permission. And that was, I thought, exciting. And all the fights they had with principals and superintendents and people trying to kill their program, both in Houston, and then Dave moved to the South Bronx fighting with principals and superintendents and other administrators who wanted to kill his program. All that friction and tension, you know, produced a great story. And at the end, you get what you had in the Escalante book, absolute confirmation that we can actually turn around the lives of millions of low-income kids if we do what Mike, Dave, and Jaime did, give them extra time and encouragement to learn.
Okay, good. Wow, a lot of ground covered there. So Harriet Ball played a key role in their development, but they also met another great teacher along the way, Rafe Esquith. He from Los Angeles. Tell us about Rafe.
You know, I call Harriet Ms. Inside and Rafe Mr. Outside. Harriet was the one who taught Mike and Dave how to handle a classroom and do those challenges to make a classroom really alive. Rafe taught them how to take what they were doing in the classroom and open up the whole world to these kids. Rafe is really, to this day, I think, the most interesting and productive and best classroom teacher still working in the United States. He still is in room 56 in an elementary school in South Central LA. And he has his fifth graders, who are about half Hispanic, half Korean, every year produce and put on a Shakespeare play. While he's doing that, he has them learn math and economics through a in-class economy that they've created. They buy and sell houses, they pay rent, they get salaries, they do loans. He has them read books way above their station. He has everybody in his fifth grade read To Kill a Mockingbird and several stuff by Steinbeck, things that would be appalling to some high school students' parents to see in their kids' book bags. But this is a fifth grader, does it? And Rafe, you know, works at least 12 hours a day. You know, I had to meet him at 6:30, and he would be in his classroom until 6. And he works on weekends. He's there almost every day of the week. That was the kind of extra time. He was giving these kids extra time and encouragement to beat the band. And when Mike and Dave saw him give a speech in Houston at a time when they were very low and thinking their whole idea for this new school wouldn't work, and he was telling them what he was doing, how well it was working, they latched onto him too. And he taught them, I think the most important lesson he gave them was to use field trips in creative ways. I mean, Rafe takes his kids out, you know, to all kinds of things out in L.A. And not only that, he takes them to the Shakespeare Festival in Portland, Oregon, takes them to the Shakespeare Festival in London, England. That through Rafe, they got the idea of having at the end of each year for every kid in the KIPP school that does well, a field lesson, a week-long field lesson where they go to cities far away and do all kinds of things that they spend much of the school year preparing for, learning about, so that when they get to the place, they really know about it. It's not the usual, you know, quick and dirty field trip. It's a deep learning experience made real by all of the preparation they've had for it leading up to it.
That's right. And you talk about the first trip they took to Washington, D.C. Tell us about that trip. How did that go?
Well, I mean, the best moment of that trip was when they started to have them, you know, go to the White House, go to the Congress, and the kids and they, having not done this before, were very frustrated because they had learned all this stuff. They knew all the paintings on the walls in the very room in the White House, but the docents in the White House were moving them through. They didn't have time for questions. They didn't have time for reflection. And they were very disappointed. You know, things were just going too fast. They wanted to really soak up each of these events because they'd studied them. So finally, they went to the Supreme Court, and it got pushed through the docents again. They were out in 30 minutes, and they were, you know, standing in front of the Supreme Court, frustrated, and wondering what to do. And Mike saw somebody look familiar and realized there was a guy in a suit who was walking by toward the entrance of the Supreme Court. It was Justice Breyer, Stephen Breyer. And so Mike, who's, you know, both of these guys are imposing. Mike is particularly imposing. He's, you know, pretty muscular, and he's 6'3". They're both 6'3". And he stops, stands in Breyer's way. Says, "Mr. Breyer, so Justice Breyer, so we come talk to our kids. We've got, you know, 80 of the hardest working kids in Houston. You know, they'd just love to meet you and talk to you for maybe 5 minutes. And so Breyer says, "Well, you know, I'm really busy. Got a meeting." No, come on, please do it. So Breyer allows himself to be dragged over to this group of Hispanic fifth graders who look even younger than 10 because they're all kind of undersized. And so he says, "Oh, kids, I hear you're working very hard in Houston. I'm very glad to see that. I hope you have a good time watching the Supreme Court. Now I got to go." And Mike says, "Hi, any questions?" And so this 10-year-old raises his question and asks Breyer, "Well, Mr. Justice, now you have to help me, Mike here. What is the thing that we read to criminals when they're arrested? Miranda." He says to the Chief Justice, to the Justice of the Supreme Court, "Were you on the court when the court decided Miranda v. Arizona, and how did you rule in that case?" And the Justice sort of stops. What is this 10-year-old who looks to be about 5 asking me and naming a case on our dock? He said, "Well, you know, I wasn't really on the court then, but I can sort of explain it to you." And by that time, he had him hooked. So they kept him there for about a half hour, and every visit since, whenever he's around, he invites the KIPP kids in. That was sort of showed what they were doing. They were taking things far beyond what you would ever expect any teacher to take, even a teacher from a wealthy school, and taking these low-income kids to a level they'd never been before.
Okay, we are talking with Jay Matthews, the author of Work Hard, Be Nice, How Two Inspired Teachers Created America's Best Schools. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back in just a moment.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Back with Jay Matthews, author of Work Hard, Be Nice. He is joining us via Skype today. Jay, thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome, Mike.
Hey, well, you mentioned earlier, and I want to go into some more detail here, all of the conflict and all of the challenges that Mike and Dave had to go through to get KIPP started and to keep it alive. Tell us a story. It's the end of Dave's second year as a Teach for America teacher. He just has gotten voted Teacher of the Year at his school, and then he gets fired.
Yep.
What happened?
There are many stories like that in the story of Mike and Dave. He was told by his principal at this school, which is mostly Hispanic kids in Houston, that the state tests were about to be given, and that he was told there was 11 kids in his class who had only recently been in the country, mostly from Mexico, and a lot of them illegal. And the principal told him, "You know, we can't have those kids, you know, suffer the stress of this state test. If you'll sign this form, we can excuse them from the test because they haven't been in the classroom long enough." And Dave said, Dave, who was working with these kids and really wanted to get them up to a place where they could get into one of the competitive middle schools in Houston. Said, you know, I've been working with these kids. I think they can pass that test. I really want them all to take it because that'll give them a chance to get into one of the better middle schools. And the principal, never having heard this from any teacher, was astonished, but he went off and tried to persuade the parents to sign the form, because under the law, if the parents signed the waiver, then the kids did not have to take this test if they hadn't been in the country very long. And the parents said to the principal, you know, that nice Mr. Levin told us not to sign anything that you asked us to sign. We're going to let him do this. And so, indeed, they took the test. Months later, they discovered that David had been right. All of his kids had passed the exam. They did have a chance to get into better middle schools. But that act, what he did, seemed to the principal absolute insubordination. So on his last day of his second year of teaching, you know, a few weeks after he'd been voted by the faculty teacher of the year, the principal came in and gave him a pink slip, which said, you know, you're out. He didn't say why, but he asked his union rep and said it was for insubordination. The timing was good because that after his second year, he was going to transfer to Mike's school, and there they were going to start the first KIPP fifth grade. So he didn't need to stay in school. He wasn't going to stay in school. But it was showing you the dead weight of bureaucratic oppression that they had to fight against, because indeed what they were doing was in many cases against what principals wanted them to do. They were going beyond the limits, and that got them into trouble again and again.
Now, you had another situation maybe a year or two later when Mike was frustrated that he was not getting the space he needed from the Houston Independent School District. They kept trying to contact the superintendent, Rod Page, who later became Secretary of Education, kept getting thwarted by his keepers. So what did he do?
Well, I mean, both of them, for the first few years of KIPPs in both New York and Houston, were fighting for more space because they started with fifth grade, and then they next year they added a sixth, next year they added a seventh, and then they needed more space. And each of them had found friendly one, I call them the den mothers, the godmothers, they, in both cases women, a woman, older woman, veterans of their systems who, you know, took a liking to them and helped to try to get them through all the red tape so they could do what they wanted to do. Mike's, the woman in Houston who was Mike's fairy godmother was Ann Patterson, who was essentially the superintendent of the West District of the Houston schools, a very important administrator. And so she was the one who was getting all this harassment from Mike saying, where's my, you know, I've got to get ready for the next year. I'm going to have the sixth graders and the fifth graders. I only have space in one classroom in this school. You got to move me to another school. And she kept saying, well, don't wait, be patient. And it turned out it was, by the time it was January, and he really had to plan and he wanted to start recruiting kids. He did something that is still remembered by many people in Houston, but he called his advocacy in action lesson for his fifth graders. He got them all together. This was, again, he just had a fifth grade, 80 kids. And he said, you know, kids, we're going to learn more about democracy here. In a democracy, he says, you know, you can make your will known by voting or by signing petitions, and also by calling people up on the phone. If you have a problem with your garbage collection, or you know, with the way your wife was treated at the local voting booth, anything like that, you can call up and complain to somebody. So that's what we're going to do. And he had a whole script. They had the memory said, hello, I'm Jose Ramos. I'm calling from the KIPP school. We're the hardest working kids in Houston. And we were told we were going to have a classroom so we could have our new school with an expanded membership next year. We don't know where our classroom's going to be. Could you really help us find out so we can continue to be hardworking and do all the things that we're doing? And Mike said, and you can't be silly about it. You know, you can't, you know, you're not Bart Simpson calling the local bar and asking if Prince Albert is still in the can. You have to take this seriously. And then he gave each of these 80 kids a list of about 20 administrators in the Houston Independent School District, top people, including the superintendent, and including poor Ann Patterson, who was working so hard to get Mike what he wanted. So the next, he had them go home and do it the next day, which was a training day for teachers. So the kids weren't coming to school. Mike was off in a classroom working with his teachers, and he got a call from the school office. He didn't have a call in the trailer that he used for classrooms, so he had to walk to the school office. And there on the phone, this was about 9 o'clock in the morning, was Ann Patterson, who was just frantic. She says, Mike, get him to stop. What do you mean, Ann? get him stopped. They're all calling. They're all calling. They're calling the superintendent. They're calling my boss. They're calling my boss's boss. You got to get him to stop. Everybody's frantic. They can't handle this. And I said, what are we talking about? I said, you know, the kids, they're calling. Where did they get the number? I gave them the number, Ann. And she says, how can you do that? It says, they're calling us and asking us all these questions. And what are you telling them, Ann? Because he was still annoyed that he had not been given his own answers. We'll deal with that later. We have to get them to stop. So eventually, he came by later that day and was reprimanded, and she wrote him up, which he thought was amusing. And in any case, all that Strum and Drog did indeed get him a new classroom and eventually reached Page's ears. The Page's people didn't tell him about this phone call, but he eventually met Rod Page, who was charmed by this guy, and he became one of Rod's best friends, and that helped him as he moved up the ladder in Houston.
And he met Rod Page by sitting on the bumper of his car waiting
for him the
day.
Yeah, that was the following year when, again, he had the same problem. And he figured out the only way to get into Page was to stake out his car, which was in a parking lot, in an open parking lot, right next to the entrance to the Houston Independent School District. And there, he waited until Rod came out. And then Mikey, who gets very impressed, said, Dr. Page, they're trying to steal my babies, which translated from Feinbergese was, you know, they're trying to keep me from expanding again to a seventh grade. And Page invited him in and sat him in a room with his chief assistant, who was really a tough woman, a great, good woman, but really tough, and said, well, you two work it out. And eventually they found him the space. It moved in that direction. And Mike, I think, is still very grateful to Rod Page to this day for seeing what he had to offer that school district.
Okay, we're talking with Jay Matthews, author of Work Hard, Be Nice. We'll be back in a moment.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
We're back with Jay Matthews, author of Work Hard, Be Nice. Jay, we've talked a lot about the founding of KIPP and about Mike and Dave. Tell us about this turning point when suddenly it became clear that they might replicate this school and go national.
Yeah, they. This was mostly Mike's doing. Dave prefers to just work with his schools, and he doesn't think that big. Mike is always thinking about expansion. Mike had gotten his school in Houston up to four grades, and it was doing great, and he got kind of bored, and heard, was contacted by a man named Scott Hamilton, who had been hired by the Fisher family, who owned the, it started and owned the Gap food chain, to find something they could do with all this, the millions of dollars they had, they wanted to do good with. And Scott had been in charge of charter schools for the state of Massachusetts, and he had heard about Mike and Dave and went to visit them and eventually persuaded the Fishers that this is the place to put your money. These guys have got a formula for raising the achievement of low-income kids that is more effective than anything I've ever seen. You know, they invited Mike and Dave to Don Fisher's expansive office overlooking Golden Gate Bridge. He said to Mike and Dave, well, you think you can do this? And Dave said, well, Mr. Fisher, we're not sure, but we'll be happy to spend your $15 million seeing if we can. And indeed, what they came up with was not a way of building more buildings, but a way of training principals. The key to the KIPP expansion is a plan to create more Mikes and Daves, which they did by picking the best teachers they could find, putting them through a year's training as principals, both at much of it at the Berkeley Business School, and then said, okay, here's the city you're going to start a charter school in. Fill out the application, recruit your kids, you're in charge, hire your teachers, and under our system, and this is crucial, you have the power to hire and fire your teachers at will based on your desire to create the kind of team that will work in a classroom for you. They're essentially letting them be Mike and Dave as Mike and Dave started their schools. And that has produced a network of schools, almost all of them, just as good as what Mike and Dave did in their first schools, and in some of them, even better. I've never encountered that happening in an expanding educational network where the schools at the end of the line, the new ones, are as good as the original ones. And that's the secret of putting the emphasis on the principal, which teaches us a lot about what's important at schools.
And so, Jay, what is it that's making these schools so successful? I understand that different schools, different KIPP schools, use different curriculum, and they vary on some things. But what's the secret sauce that's making them so effective raising the achievement of poor kids?
I think there are five things. They call them the five pillars, and I think they're similar to what Jaime did. One, high expectations for all those kids. And indeed, they tell these fifth graders coming in, and now they've got elementary schools and high school students, they tell everybody, you're going to college. That's our object, is to get you to a place where you're going to be ready and going to college and successful in college. Number one, high expectations. Number two, more time. So they have 9 to 9.5 hour school days, plus in many cases required Saturday sessions and required summer school. So they have about 67% more instructional time than regular schools. So number one is high expectations. Number two is more time. Number three is taking testing seriously. The notion, nobody, you never hear kids, people keep complaining about teaching the test. They want the test there, the standardized test that the states require them to take as a measure of how well they're doing. They're perfectly willing to be measured. And they look forward to even better tests like AP and IB in their high schools. Number four, they want to create a team spirit. You know, all the teachers together, working together as a team with the students to raise everyone's level. And last, they need a strong leader, a principal who has the power to hire and fire teachers and to create that team spirit and to be judged based on how well the whole school does. That's what works.
And it seems like when you go to KIPP schools, what they do have in common is a similar approach to building a culture of the school, the chants, the use of different of certain discipline approaches, the porch. Say a little bit about that.
The idea is that KIPP should be a safe place for all kids. And anybody who reads about KIPP on the internet is going to get the impression from people who have spent much time in KIPP schools that it's a militaristic institution and everybody's marching and saluting and never thinking for themselves, which is completely wrong. What they create is a sense of safety and peace for kids by telling kids we're respecting each other by not interrupting other kids, by not teasing other kids, by making sure that we're quiet in the hallways, by making sure we do our homework, by making sure we behave as you would find kids in our best and wealthiest public schools, wealthy institutions like Bethesda, where I'm now sitting in Maryland. And so that leads to teachers being very quick to intrude whenever a kid is not paying attention or doing some of the worst thing you can do in a KIPP school is tease or bully another child. Mike and Dave learned from Harriet Ball that you have to go right in and protect the kid who's being teased. And so they would, you know, both of them, 6 or 3, would stand on either side of the perpetrator and say, you know, are you really that smart? You can tease Freddie. Are you really doing so well? Is this the kind of thing that's going to create a team and family? And then they've created, as you said, they give each principal a chance to come up with their own discipline mat. Often they rely on what they call the bench or the porch, which is sort of intelligent isolation. If you don't do your homework, if you tease another kid, you're put on the bench, which means you still come to class, but you have to sit off by yourself. You can talk to the teacher, but you can't talk to your friends. At lunch, you can't sit or talk to your friends. You're isolated from your friends, not isolated from your education. And after a certain amount of time, if you're contrite and if you can do your homework, you get back off the bench and back to your regular life. It works pretty well, but the thing that really works is that all those teachers together are working as a team. They're disciplining the same way. They're talking to each other about their kids because they've got all this extra time, and they come up with all kinds of clever ways to make every kid know that there are adults at that school that really care about them. They're going to be watching them carefully, and if they do something that's not in their interest, they're going to be called on it and taught how to do it better.
So this has been an amazing success story, and you're obviously an advocate for the KIPP schools. At the end of the book, you get a little bit into what the detractors say. What do they say?
Well, the main points that people doubt about KIPP, and these are from bright and sensitive people who have doubts about this model. One is that KIPP is getting too much credit for its extraordinary raises in achievement. They've taken kids from ghetto level achievement levels to suburban level achievement in just 4 years. That they are getting too much credit because these are schools of choice, and some kids will drop out of KIPP. and go back to the regular schools. And they say, well, you know, they're kicking kids out, and they're only keeping the best kids, which is not true. The teachers work hardest with the kids who are struggling the most and get a lot of them to the place where they are comfortable with doing their homework and paying attention to class and do wonderfully. But it is difficult with a school of choice to persuade some parents to keep their kid in a KIPP situation where they're working very hard and meeting school 9 hours a day when they could go back to the regular school, which is only 6.5 hours a day. And since the kid is basically a nice kid, can be the star of the classroom, whereas at KIPP, where the standards are really high and take you to a place where you can actually get to college, you struggle. The parents wonder, well, you know, she's the best in her class at the regular school. Why should she have to suffer? And the answer obviously is the regular school does not enforce high standards. She's never going to get to a place where she can succeed in college if she stays in the regular school system. But parents don't see that. And KIPP is working on different ways to persuade parents that they should. But that it statistically means that the KIPP results are even better than they would be if they found some magic way to keep every kid. And the other knock on KIPP is that it's too strict. It's too intrusive on lives. Some people think it is, you know, white guys bringing their values to black ghettos, when indeed the values that the KIPP teachers, and many of them who are now black and other races, are teaching are the same values that these kids are hearing at church on Sunday. Ask any black minister who goes into KIPP school whether he likes the values being taught, and he will, you know, be singing its praises. It's the kind of values that are taught in our best suburbs. It's the kind of values that we know that young human beings need in order to succeed in our society, and that's what they teach. So those are people who tell you that it's, you know, foisting bad values or white values on kids should just be laughed at. It's and these are usually charges made by people who've never been inside a KIPP school.
Now, it seems to me that the argument that makes the most sense is that some KIPP supporters, I would say including you, Jay, have made this case that because KIPP can get these great results, that every public school should be able to get these great results. And then many supporters of public schools feel like they are being beat up on. And they're saying, look, these are parents that have chosen the KIPP model, have agreed to this more rigorous model. The KIPP schools are losing a lot of kids. That is not the same situation that traditional public schools find themselves in, where they have to take all comers. I mean, isn't there some merit to that argument that says, hey, KIPP's doing great, but let's not pretend that every public school can replicate it all the way?
I think there's some merit to the argument by logic, but there's no merit to the argument from research. We have no test of this particular proposition. I would argue that if we actually tested it, we would find that there are lots of great parents who stay in the regular schools because they don't have very high expectations for any school. And they like the fact that they know a couple of the teachers, and the teachers, you know, parents in many gated schools are happy if the school is relatively safe. In other words, my kid is not going to be shot. And the teachers are relatively kind. My kid is not going to be beat up. In their own experience and in inner city schools, that's the best they could hope for. And that's what they accept. KIPP manages to take a lot of kids who are pretty troublesome, and parents who aren't that great at backing their kids up, and turn them in another direction just by showing them for the first time that this school is not like the school they experienced as kids. This school is actually run by people who want their kids to achieve and are giving them all kinds of opportunities to achieve they did not have. That changes a lot of parental attitudes, makes a lot of people better parents than they were. We haven't really tested the proposition that these are better parents and better kids. And as you know, we now have data showing that if you take all of these good parents, they apply to get into KIPP on a lottery, and then you study, since they're applying for KIPP, they must be good parents of the sort we're talking about. And you study how well the kids do who don't get into KIPP because they lose the lottery, as opposed to those who do get in. We find that the KIPP kids who are in KIPP do much better than the kids who are not in KIPP, even though they have the same high quality striving parents who want a KIPP kind of education. So it's clearly, you know, about the school and not about the parents.
Right. And we have a more recent study finding that about a third of the original KIPPsters have made it through college within 6 years, which is about the same as you'll see for the country as a whole. So in many ways, closing that college achievement gap.
The KIPP founders, Mike and Dave, hate that study. they think it's embarrassing that they were doing so poorly. They have reached the level of you know, the national average, but that was not what they're shooting for. They really honestly want almost every one of those kids to get to college and go through college. They want 80%, not 33%. So they're tearing themselves up and looking for ways to make that happen.
So what does happen next for Mike and Dave and for Kit? The story's not over.
Right. I just talked to them in some length because both of them in tandem have decided to leave their jobs, which they gave themselves as superintendents of their cities. Mike has been the superintendent of what are now 20 schools in Houston, and Dave's been the superintendent of what are now, I believe, 7 or 8 schools in New York. And they are going to step back from those supervisory roles and become, they'll still be members of the boards of those CRIP clusters, and they will still work on fundraising and other sort of intellectual pursuits, but they'll have more time both for their families. They now both have 2 kids and have time to sort of think ahead and talk to each other and talk to other bright people and get a sense of where they can take not only the KIPP network, but the whole movement of young educators wanting to make the whole system better, public, private, charter schools. They're part of that, and you're part of that movement. I'm a very elderly observer of that movement. And that's really exciting to me because these guys are very smart, very, very practical. They know what good teaching is like. They know how to make more good teachers like that. And unleashed from their supervisory roles, I think they're going to do even more good work for kids.
And Jay, what's next for you? Are you working on another project?
Yeah, I just finished a book about something called Equity 2000, which was a movement stimulated by the College Board in the 1990s to have schools require that all kids take algebra by 9th grade. And it had a great impact on schools and taught us a lot about accelerating math for low-income kids. And I'm thinking of doing a book about high schools, sort of why do high schools define American lives? I think it's terrible. I think that when you read, you know, a press release on somebody who just made a company CEO or, you know, has hit 100 home runs, it's always where they went to college. And not where they went to high school. I think high school defines us. If we are more what we were in high school than we were in college. And high school is really the one cultural experience that almost all Americans share, unlike college. And I think that's important. And we can talk about what high school has done, made of us as a country, and how high school might change and make us even a better country.
Well, we'll look forward to that, Jay. Thank you so much, Jay Matthews, the author of Work Hard, Be Nice, How 2 Inspired Teachers Created America's Best Schools, Jay's best-selling book of his career, and you can find it on Amazon and other places. Jay, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Mike.
Join us again next time on the Education Next Book Club.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy, and I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.